KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in Forum's second hour, novelist and author Francine Prose will be joining us for a discussion all about writing and reading. Her newest book is titled Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them. She'll join us in the hour ahead, an hour which will include your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Francine Prose has published 14 works of fiction, most recently the novel A Changed Man, which we discussed with her on forum. Some of you may recall that we also had her on to discuss her much-praised book on muses. For over 20 years, she taught literature and writing courses at Harvard, Iowa, Arizona, Columbia, and the New School. She now brings her considerable experience as a writer and teacher of literature and writing, as well as an incurable lifetime bibliophile, to a book that Publishers Weekly has heralded as belonging on every writer's bookshelf, alongside E.M. Forrester's classic book on writing aspects of the novel. Her newest book is titled Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them, and she joins us for our second hour of this morning's forum. Good to see you again.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Learn to write by reading, by osmosis. That's really kind of the key to your book, isn't it?
Yeah, you'd think it would be kind of a no-brainer, as they say. I mean, how did we all learn to write? I mean, I keep admitting now I don't have an MFA. I became a novelist by reading great writers and wanting to be among them and wanting to write like they do.
But I discovered you one time thought about becoming a medievalist, and I didn't know that.
I was a graduate student in medieval literature.
Yeah. But you go into how important close reading is, every comma even, you say, and every word, and how the sense of learning to write comes through this kind of osmosis of really appreciating the word on the page and your involvement with the text.
Well, that is how writers read, and if you ask me, that's how everyone should read. You know, line by line, word by word, appreciating every decision that a writer made, word choices, why this word instead of that word, why that phrase, what kind of information we're getting from a certain phrase, you know, as opposed to the sort of more abstract. You know, one of the reasons that I found myself writing the book was I'd done a piece for Harper's years ago about how literature is taught in high schools, and it was all these kind of ethics, morals, civics, you know, what should Tom and Huck have done about Jim. And in fact, Mark Twain actually made that decision for Tom and Huck. But what's beautiful about Huck Finn is the actual words he used to put the consciousness of a teenage boy and the language of a teenage boy on the page.
Is this the article where you took on Maya Angelou? Or is that another article?
Yes, the infamous.
I remember that. Yeah. A lot of people remember that. But yeah. It's also, you know, some big questions that you're dancing around with here. One of them having to do with just how valuable, say, courses in creative writing are. And in the beginning of the book, you talk about that, and I think we're kind of in agreement like this. There may be a lot more to learn from studying the masters about writing than your peers writing or going into these negative kind of diatribes that often go on in creative writing seminars.
Oh, I know. There's the brutality. Well, I think that, you know, what the writing class is based on, the workshop, is finding something that's broken in someone else's work and figuring out how to fix it, and then some idea that you can fix your own broken problems by figuring out how to fix someone else's. And what I'm saying in the book is, why not look at someone who's done it wonderfully and brilliantly and perfectly and try and figure out how it's done well?
Well, you say that as a novelist, you often use writers when you come to an impasse, go to a novelist or to a specific novel to help you, although that can be dangerous, can't it? You can wind up adopting the person's style. I know people who are writing novels and they've read Henry James and their style just changed.
I know, it can happen. As I say in the book, you hear writers say, well, I can never read because I'm so afraid that they might influence, blah, 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 might influence my work. And I always think, you know, you wish that Tolstoy or Chekhov would. That's the best case scenario.
Yeah, if you can infuse them or you can
channel them,
yeah. Politics become too important in the way we learn literature. You were intimating this before, and perhaps there's an indictment early on in your book about just not having enough love of literature in the academy, not having or having too much concern with politics.
Well, I, you know, when I teach, and I've gone back to teaching after a break from it, I feel that I'm kind of, you know, a combination professor and cheerleader. I mean, I just go in there and say, look, I don't want to hear why you don't like George Eliot, and I don't want to hear why you don't like Virginia Woolf. These are writers who have given us pleasure and who we read years after their deaths, and our job is to find out why.
Talking to Francine Prose, her new book is Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them. Strunk and White, you have some good words to say about, but again, maybe too much negative, too.
well, I think it's marvelous. You know, grammar books, Strunk and White, and especially, you know, as I say in the book, the marvelous new Myra Kelman illustrated edition of Elements and Stuff, so beautiful. But again, for example, you might find out that you're not supposed to write sentence fragments from Strunk and White, and then you might want to read, as I quote in the book, Philip Roth, who writes the most brilliant, energized, terrific sentence fragments. That's what his work depends on. And you say, well, gee, it might be all right to write sentence fragments. I mean, you know, again, one of the things about writing workshops is they're always telling students, don't do this, don't do this. There's a rule about that. You can't do this, you can't do this. And when I teach, one of the bases I use criteria for making up a reading list is, you know, to pick writers who have broken every single rule that students have been told that they're not supposed to do. And thank God no one told these great writers those rules.
And breaking those rules makes us realize maybe that there are none, as you say later on in the book.
There are none.
And I'm glad that you talk about sentence fragments, because it's so difficult to often apprise students who write in fragments that if you can write like Hemingway or Philip Roth, then maybe it's okay to write sentence fragments. In fact, you use the whole notion of the one true sentence that Hemingway writes about in A Movable Feast and point out, I think, as is too often ignored by those who love and celebrate the great Papa, that he can write these sentence fragments, but he can also write really lovely sentences. You mentioned the bullfighting sentences. I was thinking about the trout fishing at the end of In Our Time. They're just languorous and
long, complex, beautiful sentences. Or I quote that sentence from Virginia Woolf, the first sentence from her essay on being ill, that's 181 words long. Marvel of clarity and concision, and you can't take a single word out. 181 words long.
But you still don't like Trollope, huh?
I don't. Do you? Do you, Mike? I mean,
I have mixed feelings about Trollope. Well, I went through a little Trollope phase, but there's this whole idea of sentences. I mean, you have a whole chapter on it. Never tell your publisher that you like sentences is one caveat for writers.
I know. An agent told a writer, do never, ever, ever say to an American publisher that what you care about is writing great sentences.
You also talk about reading work aloud. That's important, isn't it?
Well, yeah, for cadence, for rhythm. I mean, I quote the end of James Joyce's The Dead, the most beautiful paragraph probably, I think, in English literature. And I often teach The Dead just as for an excuse to get to read that paragraph aloud to my students. Or the last paragraph of John Cheever's Goodbye, My Brother, which is a sermon, which is this kind of gorgeous Puritan sermon, but remade in a kind of pagan style.
These are sort of from your pedagogic history, a lot of these analyses that you have here and interpretations of writers that you work with, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I'm just basically recycling everything I figured out in 20 years of teaching.
But it's great compost. You talk about the sentence. You also talk about the paragraph. You use Isaac Babel, and you have been a Babel scholar. I've read your work on Babel and also Nero Wolfe. Those two will never be paired again, unlikely at least. But that whole idea that the paragraph is like how do you put it? As singular as DNA trace or a blueprint in a crime scene.
Isn't that extraordinary? You know, I mean, as I say in the book, I wrote the book kind of like Tom Sawyer painting the fence. I mean, I was calling my friends and emailing my friends, other writers, and saying, okay, I'm writing about the paragraph. And I have to say, I was sort of amazed that so few people have written about the paragraph. You'd think the most basic unit of, you know, blah, blah. But so, and I emailed David Gates and I said, who's your favorite paragraph writer? And he said, well, actually, you should look at this Rex Stout novel, in which Nero Wolfe solves a plagiarism case by saying no two writers paragraph in the same way. And, you know, it never would have occurred to me to go to Rex Stout for literary advice, but sure enough, there it was, and it was great.
Talking again with Francine Prose, you know Christensen's work, the guy who did the generative rhetoric of the sentence and the generative rhetoric of the paragraph?
No.
Something that I couldn't help think of. What he says is that when you start a sentence, you always have to realize that you're moving forward and thinking backward, and the same with paragraphs. And it's just, it's good rhetorical advice. But then creatively, again, everything comes into new rules, doesn't it?
Yeah. You're just inventing it. You know, and that's, again, another reason to go to writers, to look at people who are just seem to be making it up as they go along.
Well, you had to trick yourself to write your first novel.
Yeah, well, that's when I talk about narrative, you know, I mean, the thing is people often say that the problem is the voice of the narrator. What's the voice of the narrator? But what I realized, and it wasn't until much later, was that the real problem is who's listening. When you're telling the story, who's listening? I mean, you're just projecting out into this kind of ozone, and there's somebody out there, you hope. So when I wrote my first novel, and actually my first short story that ever really got published, I wrote kind of old-fashioned stories within stories, you know, like Turgenev's First Love or Tolstoy's The Kreutzer Sonata, in which one character is actually talking to another character, so you know not only who's talking but who's listening, so that the second character can interrupt and ask for clarification. I mean, it kind of frees you in a way, even though it's such an old, apparently old-fashioned technique.
But a technique that works, frame.
It worked for me.
Yeah, it worked for you. I want to get into a lot of other things that you get into in the book, but underlying your book is this whole sense of, I mean, obviously, well, we share this passion for literature, and there's a sense of, though, what does literature do? I remember an interview I did with Paul Auster where he said, you know, plumbers do a lot more for us than, say, writing. That's Paul Auster.
Well, it depends if your plumbing is plugged up at that moment.
That was the implication.
You didn't call a novelist?
Yeah, exactly. But his whole point was, I mean, we get you quote Emily Dickinson, for example, that I know great poetry when my head's blown off or something like that. What it does for us in terms of as readers, you know, it lifts us, it consoles us, it has all kinds of extraordinary effects on us. But sometimes it's difficult to be really clear and concrete about that, you know.
Well, I think different books do so many different things for us that it depends. You know, I mean, for example, Tolstoy. You read Tolstoy, you read Anna Karenina, and you go, oh, my God, here's someone who lived, 100, 150 years ago, writing about people who are exactly like me and my friends, who feel the same way we do, who, you know, the little details he notices are exactly as current as they are today. Or Chekhov, you know, briefly, you go out in the world and you think, all these people who are annoying me for one reason or another, they have hearts and souls and consciousnesses, and ever so briefly, you do feel like a more compassionate person. So
ever so briefly, as you say.
Unfortunately, briefly.
Yeah, you talk about, in fact, there's a whole chapter called that alludes to God is in the details as opposed to devil in the details for writers, and you have us at a bus stop with a greasy sugar-coated cookie, I guess, and a People magazine.
I don't even think they sell those cookies anymore.
I doubt
they're
if
probably
they do.
Full of trans fats.
But there you are, at the bus stop with your pop and your cookie and your People magazine, waiting to go to your teaching assignment by bus, and there's Chekhov. I mean, opening the whole world to you in this mundane, quotidian world that you're in.
Well, Chekhov got me through a very bad year. I mean, illness in my family, the worst teaching job I ever had. But also what that chapter says is, you know, I would go into class and do the exact same thing that I sort of, you know, that I learned not to do, which is to say to students, you can't do this. You can't have two characters with similar names. And then I would get on the bus and read Chekhov's two Volodyas, in which two of the main characters were actually had the same name. Or I would say, you know, you can't switch points of view. And then I would read Gusev, in which the point of view is just flying all over the place in the last few paragraphs. So it was a real education for me in not saying these moronic things to my students, because Chekhov was teaching me, you know, all you have to do is observe the world. All you have to do is not judge what you're looking at. All you have to do is really pay attention. And all those rules just go flying out the window.
Plus, who understands the heart against itself as well as Chekhov? Your Janet Malcolm's book, do you know her book on Chekhov? It's actually pretty good.
Yeah, it is good. Yeah. And she says that kind of marvelous thing, which has always made me sort of self-conscious. When she says something like, when people mention Chekhov, they act as if a little deer has come into the room.
I like that. Well, you had the chutzpah, wherewithal, whatever, you're talking about having students relate to literature, to use Kleist in a Mormon setting. I mean, that was pretty mischievous of you, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was out to make a little trouble. But you know, it was kind of marvelous because, as I say in the book, the students all got it. I mean, it was it's the most, you know, written, 18th century, the most subversive, wicked, sly, you know, in terms of religion and character and sex and politics. And my students just all loved it. I mean, it was a real stretch for them, I thought, but they just got it. And to walk into the room and see that these you know, darling, fresh-faced, innocent Mormon students were reading Kleist and really getting it was a great experience for me.
Also a great experience for them, so it appears.
I hope so.
So it appears, yeah. So as a writer, what I mean, you're alone and you're struggling with language and putting those sentences together and tapping into your reservoir of creativity. What's the value for you?
Of writing or of reading?
Yeah, of writing.
I can't do anything else. You know, I just can't. I mean, when I say that, people think I mean just vocation, but actually, I mean, there's not a single other thing that I can do. But, it makes me profoundly happy. I just like putting words, well, it used to be on paper, but now on the screen in front of me. I like playing with a comma, taking a semicolon out. I mean, all that gives me pleasure, and there's some hope that it'll do the same thing for the reader.
But it's a kind of, in some ways, invisible drive that maybe one can't name or one doesn't know why one is summoned to it?
No, it's just, there it is one day or over a period of years, and what are you going to do about it?
Again, the newest book is called Reading Like a Writer, and in writing this book, you stayed away from fiction for a while, I presume, didn't you? I mean, you had to give a lot of attention to this book.
Yeah. I mean, I was writing it. Actually, I was writing at the same time. And the great thing, I was writing a novel at the same time, slowly. But for me, the great thing was because I was quoting so many writers in the book, and I would look for some passage that was illustrating what I needed it to illustrate, like, going to Henry Green for dialogue or going to Kleist for character or, there are, 120 books that are quoted in the book. I would type.
Is that all? I thought there were even more.
No, because actually there's that reading list at the end that was just extracted from the book.
Imperious reading list, by the way. books to be read immediately, says Francine Prose. Yeah.
But every time I would type a quote from one of these writers into my manuscript, my own writing, my own fiction writing, would get slightly better for a brief period of time. So it was very helpful to me actually writing fiction as I was writing this book.
And the two were being done simultaneously?
Yeah. I would write fiction in the morning, and then I'd go back and do this in the afternoon.
You're the ultimate of multitaskers, obviously.
Well, my parents let me watch TV and do my homework at the same time, so I've always been incredibly grateful.
Did you do the same for your children?
Yeah, I did, actually, with limited success.
But there's all that sense of laboring away at fiction and wondering, does it matter? What is the effect? Okay, it gives you pleasure, it gives others pleasure. But beyond that, what does fiction do? I've now probably interviewed more writers than just about anybody extant, and I asked myself and writers the same question over and over again without necessarily getting or pulling out and a satisfactory answer.
Well, it does so many things. If we had about 6 or 7 more hours, but one of the things my friend, the writer Deborah Eisenberg, says, which I think is particularly important right now, she says, fiction is a weapon against propaganda. So, if, for example, you're told that certain kinds of people are certain ways, if, for example, you're told that all, Muslims are a certain way, maybe you might want to read the work of Nagi Mahfouz or a writer who happened to be a Muslim, and you see that actually they're human beings. They're human beings very much like us. So it really, whatever you're told about people, or you're told that black people are a certain way, you might want to read James Baldwin, and there's a whole other view. So it really
fosters empathy, really, or humanity.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
I think Deborah Eisenberg puts it well, and so did you. Everybody has their stories. I mean, there's a whole section in here about Esalen that I found fascinating, where people
did you guess whose story that was?
No, you'll tell me off air, maybe?
No, Spalding Gray told me that story. Ah. It was something that had happened to him when he was teaching at Esalen. And talk about the power of fiction. I mean, it was about people telling sort of dueling rival stories in his class and the remarkable power that a woman who got by making up a story.
And also the importance of detail.
And the importance of detail.
Yeah, it's worth telling. I mean, here's Spalding Gray teaching this class and asking people to come forward with their stories, and you take it from me. I mean, essentially, a young woman comes forward. She's got, she's missing a leg?
She's missing a leg. She had cancer as a child. She tells a story about that. Then the next day, a guy tells a story, and it's this incredibly aggressive, pornographic, upsetting story, which does upset everybody in the class. The third day, the woman who is missing a leg says, well, actually, I lied the first day. It wasn't cancer. And then she tells this kind of crazy story about getting a cat bite from her sister's cat, and that's why her leg was amputated. But in the process of telling the story, she says, My father was a carnivore and my mother was a vegetarian. And one night at dinner, my father said, "Oh, your tofu smells so horribly." And it wasn't, of course, the tofu. It was my leg, which had been. And for some reason, the guy who told the pornographic story was horribly insulted. Oh, then she said, "I lied, actually. It wasn't a cat bite. I was telling the truth the first time. It was childhood cancer." The guy who told the story, the pornographic story, was unbelievably insulted, said, "This is a terrible class, and you, Spalding Gray, are a horrible actor," and left the class. And somehow the woman who lied, who made up the second story, knew that that was going to work that way. And Spalding said, the reason everyone believed her story was because of the detail about the tofu and the steak.
And the black cat.
And the black cat.
Yeah. And therein lies a lot of revelatory material about detail. For example, you talk about the great story of Kafka's The Metamorphosis. Gregor Samsa wakes up, he's a beetle, a dung beetle, a whatever you want to, depending on the translation. Thank heavens we have Kamsa's Garnet for Chekhov. But he wakes up, and that's what they call the dene. That's a given. You accept that, right. But maybe you don't accept that. And so you go on. Then the muff picture.
Right. He's got this picture that he's cut out of a magazine of a woman who's wearing a fur muff on her arm, and her arm is sort of disappearing. So there's this guy who's got a certain problem with kind of trans species identification, and there's a picture of a woman, and it's so convincing because it's exactly the kind of picture that a traveling salesman like Gregor Samsa might have cut out of his, you know, just dicey enough so that his family wouldn't get upset when they came into his room, but you know, ever so slightly racy.
It's also the same kind of thing comes to mind in reading A Hunger Artist, because you begin by believing, and the details help you believe,
right,
that hunger artists were real.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, no, Kafka was great at that. I mean, he just one sentence and you're there, no matter how apparently absurd the subject is.
And that opening sentence, particularly for fiction, I mean, it's almost like a lead in journalism. It has to grab attention, it has to engage, and it has to be something that really compels us.
Yeah. I mean, and Kafka claims to have learned to write first sentences from Kleist, again, going back, you know, who wrote the most outrageous, beautiful, startling and kind of weirdly journalistic first sentences.
You also write about subtext, and this is kind of a difficult area to at least expound on. You write about overhearing a conversation, a couple of men, and one's talking about Liza Minnelli.
Yeah. I had assigned my students to write to eavesdrop because we were talking about dialogue. And you know, I mean, students often have this kind of marvelous ear for storytellings and gift, and then they sit it down in front of their computer or notebook and it just all vanishes. So I said, you know, go into a cafe, go into an internet cafe, go on the subway and just eavesdrop and write down what you hear. So I thought, well, I'll try it myself. And I went into a student center, and there was a young woman at the next table, and she was telling her male companion the story about a dream she'd had in which she saw Liza Minnelli dressed as the Queen of Heaven, starry, you know, white robe, starry crown. I mean, this was the old Liza Minnelli, I should say. And her companion was very interested, but she didn't seem to notice, for example, that one thing that seemed clear to me was that her companion was gay, so he had a whole different kind of interest in Liza Minnelli than she might have thought. And she was quite attracted to him, so she was telling him the story as a kind of seduction tool, but it wasn't working that well.
There's the subtext. There's the ear of the writer and the
right,
eye of the
subtext,
writer.
Subtext, right. That's right.
Talking to Francine Prose. Again, her book is Reading Like a Writer. Talking about writing and reading with her, we welcome your calls. You can join us now, whether you're listening to us on the radio, the internet, or the Sirius satellite. Feel free to become part of this conversation. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free for your calls, and phones or lines are available to you now is 866-733-6786, or email us. Our email address here is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Francine Prose. And let me tell you, by the way, where you can meet the author. She'll be at Cody's tonight in Berkeley at 7 p.m. And tomorrow she'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera, and that's at 1 o'clock. And then in the evening at Kepler's at 7:30. Talking about writing and reading, her new book, in fact, is called Reading Like a Writer, A Guide for People Who Love Books and for Those Who Want to Write Them. And we welcome your calls. You can join us now at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum at kqed.org. I was just thinking about I mean, some of your literary interpretation and analysis here is really first rate. I mean, some of the stuff you do with Flannery O'Connor and with Raymond Carver and with writers that I've taught, you know, I think I'd like to have you come in and lecture to students that I've taught. But there's also a moment when you just, I'd quoted the line of Emily Dickinson's about feeling that poetry is like blowing your head off, where you talk about a story that had an amazing effect on me, Paul Bowles, A Distant Episode, and on many people who read it. And I thought, you described it so perfectly. It was a literary kick in the head. That's exactly what that story is.
It's so violent. That story is so fun. But, you know, I used to teach that story and feel really guilty because it is so violent and so disturbing. But now kind of Quentin Tarantino has made it a little easier for me. It's, I no longer feel quite so worried about it. But, you know, but also it's about the interface between between Arab culture and Western
yes.
culture. And, you know, after 9/11, when people were saying, who should we read now? What literature is relevant? And people were saying, oh, you know, Dostoevsky's The Possessed or Conrad's The Secret Agent. It was amazing to me that no one spoke about Paul Bowles, who knew more than anybody about what that interface between those two cultures is like.
A lot more than T.H. Lawrence, for example. Yeah.
Well, maybe.
But that, I mean, it's a story that shows, again, the kind of impact that fiction can have, just because it sets you off in a kind of electric shock almost, doesn't
sure.
it?
Sure, but again, it's also a story that shows how important it is to read closely because, you know, as you know, it's about this professor who goes traveling in Morocco and something terrible happens. Well, if you just read it on the surface, you think, okay, you go to these places where you shouldn't go and, you know, bad things happen, and that's what happens to people in those places. But if you read it closely, you realize that the professor makes one little cultural mistake after another from the minute he arrives in this town. And, you know, it's not as if his punishment exactly fits his crime, but
no.
it's not but it's not as if he's a completely innocent victim either.
But that's the brilliant subtlety that you get at in the story. I mean, is that frequently you can miss the forest and the trees.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Let's go to our callers, and let's begin, Annie, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm making a documentary film about Tilly Olson, and I wondered, Francine, if you've ever taught Tilly or have you read Tell Me a Riddle?
Of course I've read Tell Me a Riddle, and I heard Tilly read in the 80s, I think.
Tilly
in the
used
early...
to call
Oh,
the
show. Yeah.
By
really?
The way, yeah, she used to be a regular caller because she lives in San Francisco.
Yeah, so... she's in Berkeley now.
Ah, okay. What did you want to ask Francine, though?
I just wanted to know if you ever taught Tilly in your classes.
No, I haven't.
Okay, that's all. Thank you. Okay. I would suggest you might try it. I've reread Tell Me a Riddle a number of times now since I've been making the film, and I'm just astonished at her choice of language and her care. And
well,
you know,
I taught her. I've also taught While I Stand Here Ironing, by the way.
I'll go back and look at it again. Thanks for the suggestion.
Yeah, thank you, Annie, for the call. And let's get Laura on with us next. Laura, good morning.
Good morning. I'm an educator, 37 years. I find it incredible that you're talking about so irreverently about the sentence and the paragraph. But as you know, in the state of California, Northern California, 40,000 students did not pass the exit exam. We're standing on our heads trying to get students to understand sentences and paragraphs. And as far as reading, let me tell you something. I don't know how far removed you are, but students are not reading anything, and especially when you talk about Emily Dickinson, that's you and I our heritage of reading and of having grandparents and mothers sitting down and reading to us.
That is not happening.
My question
Wait, get your point, but what's the irreverence?
My question simply, I don't care about the
No, you use the word irreverent. What do you mean by irreverent?
You talking about the sentence and how you don't have to understand the sentence and fragments. We're trying to get students to understand what a sentence is. Now, how can you, in all of your ability, help teachers to talk to teach students who are so far removed from anything that's written, fiction or nonfiction? Tell me, what's your opinion on that?
I have some ideas. I'm very glad you asked. I have in the last couple of months, I've had a kind of marvelous experience of going into classrooms in New York, not in California, but in very, very apparently, you know, tough schools. I mean, really, really tough schools. I mean, DeWitt Clinton High School, which is one of the toughest schools in New York City. I was just there last week, and I was there about 6 months before. And it was the honors class, I mean, I'll admit it, but it was kids from the neighborhood, and they were amazing. They were reading, I have to say, Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal. They got every line, they got every joke, they got every bit of subtext. One thing, you know, after I wrote that article for Harper's about the way literature is taught in the school, one thing that seemed to me very clear and very much a problem was that the curriculum was mandated, that is, what teachers were teaching was given, they were given a list of things to teach by the state board or regents or so forth. And it seemed to me that if teachers were allowed to choose at least one or two things every semester, a work that they felt passionately about, a work that they felt themselves intimately connected to and could be, as I said at the beginning, cheerleaders for that work, at least it would be, you know, more help for the students to get that kind of enthusiasm and get that kind of passion from their teachers, and students would pick up on it.
But she's right in that students are not reading and sometimes are very adverse to reading, particularly young students. And the fact of the matter is, can you teach them about, say, the gracefulness and beauty of the sentence and how sentence fragments can be so creative and wonderful when they don't know how to write a sentence or don't understand the nuts and bolts of a sentence?
Well, the first thing is to get them to read. That really is the first thing. And I think, you know, and again, I wrote one young adult novel, and I've been going into schools to talk to kids about that. And they want very simple things. They want that sort of old-fashioned delight in storytelling, in one thing happening after another, in wanting to know what happens next. And I know from my own kids, my own experience of their education was that they were taught so many books that they found boring, that I found boring and alienating, that it was very hard to get around that and begin them with books that kept actually on the simplest level, kept their attention.
So that's why a lot of teachers will choose a book like Cageburg, though, because they say, after, especially say in the inner cities, this is a book that kids can relate to.
Relate to and stay interested in are two very different things.
Well, I mean, it is. I think you would even admit with some of your criticism of Maya Angelou's syntax and prose and grammar and all that, that it's a compelling story.
You know, once you write something, then you realize what you should have written. I mean, what I wish I'd written in that piece is that if that book created one passionate reader as a consequence of reading that book, then I'm so glad. So that's, you know, I somehow neglected to point out that apparently obvious.
Same for Harry Potter and Sweet Valley Twins.
Absolutely,
and any of
those, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Let me thank Laura for her call, and we'll go to more of your calls. Dick, join us. Morning.
Yeah. Hi. Remember a while ago you recommended Middlemarch at great length?
I certainly did.
Well, I took the 30-year-old copy off my shelf, and I read it. Did you know that some of George Eliot's sentences can be parsed in as little as 20 minutes? And it made me into a Middlemarch bore for a month because I kept on saying, wait a minute, you got to listen to this.
I'm so happy to hear that. I'm so glad. I mean, I thought, you know, what am I doing passionately and, you know, advising everyone to read Middlemarch? But that's what I was doing. I'm thrilled to hear that.
Oh, yeah. Can I throw one back at you?
Sure.
Vasily Grossman, Life and Fate.
Oh, I just got that. Actually, it's in that New York Review of Books series. They just reissued that.
Sorry, clue us in. What are we talking about here?
It's a book written about what? About the siege of Stalingrad,
right? It is the war and peace of the 20th century. Yeah. It is the most subversive book anybody in the Soviet Union ever wrote, and the fact that he didn't get shot for it is a miracle.
Well, thank you for that
recommendation.
That's, speaking of war and peace, and you've mentioned Tolstoy a few times here, heard this heated argument about Tolstoy, and I guess it's been going on, it's kind of a perennial argument about whether or not his later work, particularly when he became more homiletic and didactic about Christianity and the like, is to be taken as seriously.
Well,
where
he did get kind of
that?
Goofy, you know, I mean, all that sort of, you know, the truth lies in the peasants, and he became a kind of religious nut of a certain sort, but so.
Still tell
so
us
the guy wrote
narrative,
it,
right?
Really. Yeah.
Here's Jennifer from Palo Alto who sends the following email. I want to look at some of your emails here. There is one rule for writing, and that is to write so that others can understand. The rules we learn in school are supposed to help with that, just as traffic laws exist to prevent collisions. But sometimes we break traffic rules because we know we won't crash. Sometimes we break rules of grammar because we know we will be understood.
Clarity is all.
Here's Don, who says, I believe it was Thomas Peacock who asked essentially, what have poets ever achieved? Peacock provoked Shelley to write my favorite answer to that tiresome question, poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Which Auden used as well, of course. And here's Kathy, who says, reading fiction is healthier than drinking alcohol or taking drugs for escape and looking at the world beyond our own point of view. It helps me to understand my own feelings about life better than therapy. And Alex says, Michael, one famous Russian author, Yuri Nagibin, recalled how he, when he was a beginning writer, was literally hand rewriting Anton Chekhov's stories to better understand how great writers do it.
Well, you know, I had an eighth grade English teacher. You know, the book is dedicated to three of my teachers. But then there was another teacher who I didn't get along with in the eighth grade, and she made us copy out a Chekhov story, copy it. I mean, literally just, by hand. And we thought, oh, this is just typical of the tedious, boring, useless stuff she makes us do all the time. But I've always been grateful for it.
Can you imagine somebody in today's schoolroom saying, copy a Chekhov story? Well, again, we're taking your calls, and you might want to weigh in here on why you read and why you write and what it does for you, or what do you think it does for those who may be reading you, if you're a writer or if you want to be a writer. And certainly there are legions of aspiring writers, more writers, I think Gaetelise said to me, Nantelise, his wife said to him, more writers than there are readers by far, or would-be writers. Yeah?
I'm a little worried about that.
Our phone number, by the way, for your calls, toll-free is 866-733-6786, or once again, you can email us, and the email address here is forum@kqed.org, as we continue with Francine Prose. And Violet, welcome.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very much enjoying the program today. It touches on a lot of things that are very, very dear to me. My sister was a teacher for many years, and she taught at-risk children. And she found that they didn't want to read. I was thinking about an earlier caller who was very venomous and seemed to be attacking the guest, and I apologize for that. But how she handled this, and it's something that you said earlier on, and I was in my car going, amen. Show them the beauty of language. This is something that seems to have not been passed on to a lot of people. And what she would do in her classroom is she would present everything that she had been told these children would not be able to grasp. Case in point, Shakespeare. She would present them with Shakespeare. She would give them the books. She would show them a film. And she would stop the film periodically to discuss the reality of what Shakespeare was writing. And by the end of the program, these children were fired up to read. Now, granted, they weren't the best readers in the world, but they knew the beauty of language. And I appreciate what is being presented today, because that's exactly what I hear coming from you. And
you're joining us from Texas, Violet, right? Where in Texas are you?
Well, it's right. It's in Denton, Texas, where Texas University is, University of North Texas. We're about 30 miles outside of Dallas.
Well, so good to hear from you, and thank you for the call. Often you can get through to young people with lyrics. I mean, they certainly listen to and like and are engaged by the lyrics they hear in music, or just stories and the way stories evolve and the way they can tell their own stories. There's also this whole field of literary criticism, as I'm sure you're well aware, called reader response, and you get to talk to young people about... I actually went to... high school reunion and was asked to teach a class in my high school. It's largely African-American, and they were teaching Hamlet. They were wrestling with Hamlet. And to make Hamlet on a level where they responded to the characters seemed to me to be much more useful for their purposes. That is, you know, how do you react to this mother and this whole relationship with the mother and, you know, all that?
Well, also, literature is so subversive, and there's so many things that are said in literature that they're, you know, I mean, to go back to my experience at the University of Utah with those kids, I mean, I was teaching them a Flannery O'Connor story, Everything That Rises Must Converge, and I said, well, it's partly a story about being embarrassed by your parents. Has anyone in the room ever been embarrassed by his or her parents? And it was so, you know, watching the hesitance with their little hands went up, and finally they admitted. And it was this kind of, you know, unsayable thing that Flannery O'Connor had said, and finally they were able to say it.
It's also, I mean, that story is a good example on another dimension of how young people particularly can be hostile toward their parents, as Julian is toward his mother in the story, and then realize, especially when her eye is cockeyed,
and realize
that she's very dear to him.
Of course. I know, it's an incredibly moving story.
We'll move to more of your calls. Jeff, hi.
Hi. Am I on the air?
You're on the air.
Oh, wonderful. I unfortunately haven't read your book, but what I was wondering about, and I'm coming back from class right now, I just got out of my American Lit to 1865 class. And as someone who writes and someone who reads, I haven't yet to find anything in that class that I found helpful to me as a writer. And I was wondering if you could tell me that you think that there are, you know, works that even in our own language aren't helpful to writers.
Well, the book has a list at the back, as Michael said, books to be read immediately, and there are 118 works in this list, each one of which I think would be enormously helpful, just if you slow down and read it carefully and say, how does this writer do this and how is this writer doing that? You know, pretty much anything can be helpful if it's very good and if you're reading it with that eye to how did this writer do this kind of amazing thing.
That's the questions that need to be asked, Jeff. You know, look at the craft and how is it done and think about it and see what you can discover. Good luck to you. Here's Nancy, who asked Francine Prose, I'm writing my first novel. You have a favorite resource for teaching novel plot structure or thoughts about structuring plot?
I wish I knew. I mean, you know, I've written all these novels and I feel like I'm making it up from scratch each time, reinventing the wheel each time. I don't know. I start with the first sentence and write the second sentence and then the third and the fourth and so on, but I don't recommend this as a way of writing for anyone because you wind up with a certain number of unfinished novels in your drawer.
Plot can be the toughest part. I mean, I remember Michael Chabon in an interview we did saying how much he loves language and he loves coming up with things imaginatively, but the plot and putting that plot structure down is very challenging. It's the ultimate challenge.
Yeah. Well, I think I tell in the book the story of Harry Cruse, who took apart a Graham Greene novel chapter by chapter and just said, you know, in the most analytical way, how much time is covered, what happens in each chapter, what happens between chapters, how many characters are there, whose point of view. I mean, you can, you know, if you look at a novel and just analyze it in that way, sometimes it can be very helpful.
Just did an interview with Edward P. Jones. I don't know if you know his work. He's a very impressive writer. And he was saying, I know I want to get a character from one place to the other place, but I have to find the language to do that. I mean, that seems to me to be kind of a key of what you're facing when you're facing the so-called blank page and trying to put that down.
Well, sometimes you can just have a space break and have them show up in the next place without even getting them from one place to the other.
See, that's a seasoned writer talking. Here's Jonathan who says, thank you for this fascinating discussion. As a young writer and undergraduate student, I'm troubled by the criticism commonly given to MFA programs. I wondered if your guests had any suggestions on how to navigate this dilemma. Not sure which dilemma he's talking about.
Well, you know, it's not as if... And I say this, it's not as if there's no value in going to an MFA program. I mean, you can learn certain things. You can learn how to line edit your work. You can learn how to edit your work. You can learn what effect your work is having on other people. And you can make a community of friends who will be your friends for the rest of your life as a writer. So that's quite useful. But again, you know, if I had to choose between learning from my fellow students and learning from George Eliot, I know where I go.
And let's go to more of your calls, and we go to Brad in San Francisco. Morning, Brad.
Good morning. I'm driving my cab around San Francisco this morning. I'm a published author of two books published by Random House and by the local house Traveler's Tales. And I just got a chuckle out of the more would-be readers, would-be writers out there than would-be than there are readers. It is true. I get invited to a... occasional writing conference, and the course that I teach there is called Stop Writing Now, in which I try to enlighten people to the realities of the writing world and tell them that if you have to write, go for it, you know, do it. The world needs writers, but on the other hand, here's the reality. You know, there's so many people out here driving cabs and waiting tables, and the person in my back seat just now told me they're a would-be painter. so we're getting a great chuckle out of this.
Glad you're aboard. Thank you for the call. We'll go to more of your calls. Nancy, morning.
Hi. I've been reading Francine Prose since her very first book of Judah the Pious, which I gave to everybody I knew back in the very long time ago. And I'm an avid reader. I have been ever since I was a child. I love books. I've always got one with me. And I have wanted to write, but either I'm not passionate enough about it, or I don't have the talent. But I think that there is that leap from being a reader to a writer that is some mysterious thing, I guess. I've written books in my head and, you know, just never been able to get them down on paper. And anyways, that's my comment.
You're like a lot of folks, I think.
Good luck.
Francine Prose. Wishing you good luck. And thank you, Nancy, for your call. From Palo Alto, Carol joining us. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Michael, and hi, Fencing Pros. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I wanted to bring up 2 points. My first one is when I was listening to the program, I could not stop thinking about Charles Bernstein. He is one of my favorite language poets, and once he said that creative writing workshop should really be called creative reading workshop, because that's what he's saying is that people should be exposed to a lot of works of literature and learn from that rather than criticize their own writing. And I think that's pretty much what Francine Prose is saying. And another point that I wanted to make is that I actually was struggling with my own writing for a long time. I had trouble coming up with narratives or with long stories. And then one day I just thought to myself, why don't I just write about how books have influenced me? You know, since I've read a lot of them throughout my life. And so I think that, each book has taught me something else, and I'm grateful for that.
And we're thankful that you called us. Thank you for the call. You know, somebody might ask you, how do I make myself read? I mean, there are people, for example, who can make themselves write, but they have more trouble making themselves read.
Well, haven't you noticed that there are times when you can read and times when it's harder? I mean, I do. I find that myself. So I don't know. Maybe the answer is patience. Or take a lot of long, boring train trips or airplane, train trips particularly when you can't. I mean, airplanes have the distraction of the movie. There's nothing you can do on the train, or bus trips.
Yeah, in your case, the bus trips.
Yeah, the bus trips.
Here's Steve, who says, there's evidence that young people are adopting the Internet as a communications and life-sharing tool. It is clear that they are moving away from books. Why not organize teaching creative or nonfiction writing around student blogs in some intramural or outside network? Assignments could emphasize many topics to be assigned as appropriate.
Well, blogs are the reality of their own. Although now I have to say I've become very blog conscious because people are blogging about this book. So now I find myself reading blogs. You know, people are always saying the book is dead, book culture is over, and no one's reading books anymore. But I've been thrilled, really, and amazed by the response to this book. I mean, it seems to me to at least give some evidence that people are still interested in books and interested in reading and interested in writing. And
what's the demographic, though? I mean, I don't know how you assess that or gauge it.
I don't know. But there have been certainly enough people who've been interested. And I'm, aside from the obvious personal gratification, it just makes me so happy as a writer to know that there are people who are interested in reading out there.
Well, on the other hand, we have this email from Morgan Hill, a listener who writes, I agree with one of the previous callers about reading and the state of education. My niece is in her 20s. She's a teacher in Southern California. She has only read one book in her life. How did this happen?
No, that's so sad.
Sad. It's it's lugubrious. Dan, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if your guest could comment on a process that takes place. I've only been writing for a few years. But now I find myself reading books and almost analyzing them too much, and rather than just reading it and enjoying it, kind of like musicians who go out and watch other bands. They sometimes go just to see what other people are doing, not really to enjoy the music. And I'm wondering if your guest ever ran into that situation where you're reading and you're just picking up points and analyzing rather than just reading the book.
Well, I think, again, what I should have said in the book, the first time you read a book, read it. Just read it for pleasure and for what happens and for enjoyment. And then go back and see how the writer has done, the things that have made the book so marvelous. And the book that inspires you to go back and do that, that tells you something, too. I mean, why is this book the one that I want to go back and take apart every word and learn something from?
That is excellent and wise advice. Couldn't concur more. I mean, because all too often you'll hear people say, I don't want to think about what it means, or I don't want to analyze, especially students.
Yeah.
So enjoy it first.
Yeah.
And thank you for the call. We'll get to more of your calls. Jennifer, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Sure. Hi, Michael. Hi, Francine. Hi. Thank you both very much for doing this great program. And I'm afraid I'm going to fulfill the stereotype of the pedantic teacher, but we really are in the Quentin Tarantino age. But Emily Dickinson, her line is that poetry makes her feel as if the top of her head has come off. So no bombs or explosions, although it's explosive in its way.
Sorry, I'm not sure I got the point, Jennifer. Sorry.
Oh, just because you kept saying that it's as if her head her line is that her head blows out.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're giving the being exact. I see. Not pedantic, but appropriately pedagogical. Thank you for that.
Pedant that I am, but there it is. But thank you both very much.
No, thank you for that that correction. Your focus, though, here is on fiction, and yet I think it's so important that people read and appreciate poetry. We've done enough programs on it, and it's clear that, you know, I'm a bit of a missionary on that score, and yet poetry has kind of morphed into a different sort of, well, you know, people would say, yes, there's poetry out there. It's a different kind of poetry. It's rap, or it's the fast speeded up poetry versions of oral sort of communication that you hear at these events that celebrate this sort of thing. You get to the point where you think, but it's not really poetry somehow. It's different than poetry, the poetry at least we were raised with, isn't it?
Well, two things, Michael. First of all, the last thing I quote in the book is a poem. It's that great poem, Five Men, by Zbigniew Herbert. And in fact, I wish I'd thought of it earlier in the program, because that is the perfect example. That's the perfect answer to the question of why write, or why would you be writing in this terrible time when there's so much war and suffering. I mean, it's just this gorgeous poem about that. Also, I've heard a couple, one in particular, poets who combine, you know, the sort of the rigor of traditional poetry with the rhythms of rap poetry. And if they're real, I mean, Craig Arnold, there's a young poet who's now in Wisconsin who does this, who's marvelous. So I think there's some of that going on too. So great.
Let me get to more of your calls here. We have a caller, Catherine, joining us next. Hi, Catherine.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Just a great conversation, and I have a little comment and then a question. You know, when I graduated from college, I unfortunately could barely formulate a complete sentence, and happened to marry an attorney who taught me the art of putting your thoughts together sequentially, and then putting identifying the correct words to put sentences together. I know that sounds really basic.
You know, this is going to sound terrible, but, you know, I just realized we're out of time, Catherine. I'm sorry about that. This is a first. Enjoy the time, as always, with Francine Prose. You can meet her tonight at Cody's in Berkeley, tomorrow at the Book Passage store at 1 o'clock, and at Kepler's 7:30 tomorrow. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.